Debate has opened up in the Australian public after US President Donald Trump criticised the Turnbull government's refugee resettlement deal. US Press Secretary Sean Spicer has said that the deal will continue to go through, but with extreme vetting from the US government. There's still a lot of confusion, though, surrounding this and whether it will go ahead. Donald Trump is a bit of a wild card. This morning we have with us human rights lawyer Julian Burnside QC for his take on this ongoing situation. How are you going today?
G'day. How am I going today? Well, I'm actually getting increasingly depressed by what's going on in the world.
Yeah. Okay. Tell us a bit about your thoughts on this whole global shift, this blocking of refugees, this sort of war against Islam. What's your take on it?
Well, I think the war against Islam is at the core of it. There's been a massive shift to the right in, most of the Western world, it seems. You know, Brexit is an obvious example. Donald Trump is an obvious example. Marine Le Pen looks like a real possibility in France, and that tells you something about where politics has shifted. I mean, the bizarre thing about this is that most of my life I've been completely uninterested in politics, and I had for many years been a liberal voter. I'm now regarded as a rusted-on lefty, but I don't think my views have shifted very much. It's just that the political spectrum has moved so far that people who were once sort of comfortably in the centre are now regarded as hard left. It's bizarre.
And do you think there is a sort of war on human rights?
Oh, there's a war on human rights. In my view, human rights thinking, I mean, if you look across history, human rights thinking in the modern era really started at the end of the Second World War when the concentration camps were opened up and the world sort of drew back in horror at what had happened, and a new era of human rights thinking began. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was a very obvious example of that, driven by Eleanor Roosevelt, largely, very substantially contributed to by Australia, which was then an even smaller international presence than it is now. When you look at the great international human rights instruments, they all come in the wake of the Second World War and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But on September 11, 2001, I think the tide turned, and little by little, the idea of human rights has become less fashionable, less popular, less acceptable, and thinking which is utterly incompatible with the idea of human rights has become increasingly acceptable and even mainstream. I mean, the idea that, for example, in Australia, we've had politicians, especially liberal politicians, for the last, 10 or 15 years, talking about boat people as illegal, which is absolutely false. You know, they're liars saying that. They're not illegal because they don't commit any crime, and we treat them like criminals and call them illegal and call the exercise border protection. Now, that is something which completely ignores the lessons which we thought mankind had learned after the end of the Second World War.
Mm. Julian Burnside QC is with us. We're talking about this global shift in politics and the way that we treat refugees. Do you think a lot of this comes down to fear, the way in which we're responding to the refugee crisis and people's concerns with Muslim culture?
It's partly fear and it's partly a sense of entitlement. Behaviour which was once utterly unacceptable has now become more or less acceptable, and so you get people speaking out and saying things which decency and good manners would have prevented them from saying even just a few years ago. Islamophobia is undoubtedly at the heart of a lot of the thinking. It's very interesting that on September 11, 2001, all of a sudden in the West, you no longer had terrorists, you only had Muslim terrorists. And in Australia, you no longer had boat people, you only had Muslim boat people. And that's when they started being referred to here as illegals. And there is a very, very strong strand of public opinion, it seems, which the politicians have picked up on, a strand of public thinking which says that all boat people are probably terrorists and therefore we have to protect ourselves from them. Now, it's pretty easy to see in Trump's administrative order about Muslim arrivals in America, but the same thing, it is Islamophobia. And, you know, I don't adhere to any religion, although I was brought up Anglican. I think that the way Muslims are treated in public discourse these days is absolutely appalling. And frankly, from what I remember of Christian teaching, Christian attitudes to Muslims is utterly inconsistent with what the founder of Christianity taught.
There have been a lot of parallels drawn between the way we treat Muslim people today and the way Jews were treated back before World War II and during that time. Do you think it's a fair comparison, that, and also the sort of the comparison with Donald Trump and Hitler, which I'm sure some people would have a bit of a problem with?
Yeah, look, I do think the comparison is valid. I think Islamophobia is the new anti-Semitism. And I just hope to goodness it doesn't take an equivalent of the Jewish Holocaust to have people remember that these people are first and foremost human beings. Their actual religion is really secondary to that. I think comparing Donald Trump to Hitler is in many ways reasonable. But remember, Hitler's approach to the Holocaust really started at the time of Kristallnacht in November 38 and then got worse. I think what Hitler did was to mount a coup. What Trump is doing looks awfully like a coup. He's attacking the rule of law. He's attacking judges who disagree with him about the legality of his immigration ban. And, you know, he's been banging out executive orders like the early Stuart Kings. It's extraordinary. It really does look like a coup. And whenever you see someone take power the way he did and then start damaging the institutions of government, it's reasonable to be fearful that there's a coup happening.
Julian Burnside, human rights lawyer, is with us. So there is still a bit of confusion around whether there will be this deal with the Turnbull government, the refugee resettlement deal. The press secretary said that the deal will continue with extreme vetting. Do you know what that would mean?
No, I don't. I don't. I mean, it may be, at the worst, it may be that they say, OK, if you're Muslim, you don't pass the test. That'd be pretty brutal. If it means that they get enhanced interrogation, that would obviously be unacceptable. I mean, we're talking 80% of the people now held on Manus and Nauru have already been assessed by Papua New Guinea on the one hand, Nauru on the other hand. They have already been assessed as genuine refugees according to the Refugees Convention test of refugee status. Now, I don't know what more vetting you need to do. But then Donald Trump appears to be a maniac in some respects. He recently justified the fact that one of the people detained at one of the American airports last week was a five-year-old child who'd been held in handcuffs. And he justified that on the footing that you never know what a five-year-old might do. Now, you know, if that's his level of thinking, then the world is in trouble.
Well, okay, so we've got a lot of people in detention, you know, a majority of whom are genuine refugees. How long have they been there? What's the process? Are they still languishing, just still waiting?
They're still languishing in appalling circumstances, you know, desperately hot, humid, in conditions that give them no possibility of comfort or even of hope. They've been there, most of them, for a bit over 3 years. It's so bad that people have been killing themselves. There's a very interesting observation about this. Our government, Tony Abbott initially and now Turnbull, have said dishonestly that the reason for all of this is because they are worried about people drowning, which was complete nonsense, because the logic of it was, we're so worried about you drowning that if you don't drown, we'll jail you. That's really what's been happening. Anyway, you may recall that during 2016, early first half of 2016, a bloke on Nauru called Omid Masumali. He and his family had been assessed as refugees. There was no third country that was looking like taking them. It looked like they might have to spend the rest of their time on Nauru. The locals on Nauru are utterly hostile to refugees, and they were so desperate at the idea of spending the rest of their time on Nauru as refugees that Omid Masumali publicly doused himself in petrol and set himself on fire. He died. And Kathy Wilcox, who's a very good cartoonist, did a cartoon which was simply a man engulfed in flames, and the caption read, "Not drowning." Now, we have had more people dying in immigration detention in Nauru and PNG. You have to remember that if they go there and kill themselves or are killed by the people who are supposed to be protecting them, they're still dead, just as dead as if they'd drowned. If they set out and are turned back by our Navy and they die on their way back, they're still dead, just as if they'd drowned. If they stand their ground and face their persecutors rather than trying to seek safety, if they're killed, they're still dead, just as if they'd drowned. And yet, the difference, it seems, is that we won't notice. We won't notice their death, so we won't be troubled by it. I think any Australian politician to express concern about people drowning in their attempt to reach safety is a dishonest hypocrite. And that, unfortunately, is the character of modern politics in Australia. It's marked by dishonesty and hypocrisy.
I imagine a major part of it is meant to be a deterrent from coming to Australia.
Yeah, well, how's the logic of that? Deter people from seeking a place of safety, deter people from trying to escape the same extremists that we're fighting in the Middle East.
How do you propose we tackle this? I feel like there should be some kind of global attempt where everyone, actually developed nations, actually come together and organise a better way of resettling people who are desperately in need of resettlement. What do you think we should be doing better?
Well, everything. We should stop doing everything we're doing at the moment, because it's hard to think of anything that could be much worse, apart from mass slaughter. And frankly, I wouldn't put that past Donald Trump, and I wouldn't put it past some of the right wing of the Australian Liberal National Government. Although I have to say, in all seriousness, I do not believe that the Australian government would ever try to start killing refugees. Mistreating them seems to be enough for their purposes. What should we do differently? Well, in Australia, for example, I would say, okay, immediately shut down the offshore detention centres and stop bumping people offshore. Bring those people to Australia and resettle them in the community. Accept the likelihood that boats will start arriving again. But if they do, and if they have to be detained, let them be detained initially, but cap the detention at 1 month and use that 1 month for preliminary health and security checks. That strikes me as reasonable. But then at the end of that month of detention, release them into the community on visas which have major conditions that include they must stay in regular contact with the department until their refugee status is decided. They're allowed to work, basic human right. They're allowed access to Centrelink and Medicare benefits, basic to human decency in a society like Australia. But crucially, I would say that until their refugee status is decided, they must live in a specified regional or rural town. Now, I did some figures on this a while ago, and if the highest ever arrival rate of boat people of 25,000 in 1 year, if that became the new normal, and if they were all farmed out to regional towns and cities across Australia, and if every single one of them stayed on full Centrelink benefits, which is highly unlikely because these are clearly motivated people, let's assume, though, that we have 25,000 people a year arriving and all of them stay on full Centrelink benefits, and they're all living in regional towns and cities. What would that cost the Australian economy? Well, $500 million. That's easy because we know what Centrelink pays. Of course, all that money would be spent in the failing economies of regional cities and towns, so that would be good for them. At the moment, we're spending something like $5,000 million a year mistreating them, and most of that money gets thrown at other countries and large corporations that have the contracts to guard them and mistreat them and so on. So we could actually save thousands of millions of dollars each year, and we could behave decently, and we could help rural Australia at the same time.
Well, we'll watch this space, shall we, Julian? Thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thanks, Jenny.